This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. I'm Yehiz Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
There's been a lot of kind of nodding to African suggestions that they need to have a bigger role in the international financial institutions, the IMF and the World Bank, not just in terms of voting power, but also in terms of agenda setting. There's not been a whole lot of engagement on that, in all honesty, in very concrete terms from the United States.
That was Columbia University political scientist and African economist Harry Verhoeven, who says Kenyan President Ruto is pushing the U.S. to speak for Africa when it comes to restructuring debt. Details coming up. Also, South Africa's Democratic Alliance Party is among those aiming to loosen the African National Congress's 30-year grip on power. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. After a state dinner at the White House last night filled with celebrities and conversation, Kenyan President William Ruto has been attending a U.S. Chamber of Commerce event today celebrating the economic ties between the two countries. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris will join Ruto at the event, as will the U.S. Secretary of Commerce Gina Raimondo and business leaders from both countries. VOA's Paul Ndiho has been at the event and he joins me now by phone. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Paul.
Thank you, Yahya.
So, can you start by filling us on the purpose of this event?
Terrific. Thank you, Yahya. I think this is one of those events that culminates President Ruto's visit to the United States. Today, they were looking at how businesses in the United States can leverage the openness, the environment, the business environment in Kenya to do business there. As we speak, five major multi-billion-dollar deals have been signed between the U.S. government, the private sector, and the Kenyan government. And this is all geared towards taking investment in Kenya, building technology labs, building energy infrastructures that is going to propel the country of Kenya to the next level.
And who are the speakers been, and what have they focused on?
Largely, since morning, there's been a series of speakers from tech giants, the Microsofts, the Googles, the Flickr, to Kenyan tech companies or Kenyan business community, including President Ruto, who said that Kenya is open for business, basically reiterating the message that she has been telling American businesses that if you want to invest in Kenya, Kenya is open for business. What he did today, he also announced that for any tech companies wanting to invest in Kenya, they are going to have a tax a grace period where they are not paying taxes, and for any startups that open businesses in Kenya, they will not be taxed at all until they are profitable.
Our reporter, VOA Paul Ndiho at the Chamber of Commerce, reporting from there. Thank you for your input, Paul.
Thank you so much for having me.
Journalist Ruben Chama also has been speaking with people in Nairobi to hear their thoughts about President Ruto's visit to the United States. Bernsi Ingeri, a lecturer at Kenya Methodist University, hopes the visit brings several benefits, including improved pop culture ties and technology links.
Kenyans expect better relations with the U.S., especially in the visa processes. Because we have been talking about how it's expensive to get a U.S. visa. We expect that Kenyans going to the U.S. will find it easier to get a visa. We also expect better economy, better IT, because we know America is the hub of technology. I saw that he also went with some celebrities, some media personalities, some comedians. We also expect the entertainment industry to be boosted, and hope that the Kenyan celebrities can also get a bigger market out there. I think President Biden, as the president of the U.S., can help Kenya in terms of cybersecurity. We rely so much on internet now that we are in the technology era.
Angel Kamwiti is a student of international studies at the University of Nairobi. She hopes the visit leads to more student exchange opportunities with the United States.
Personally, I'd look at it like I'd want more cultural and social exchange programs, even for students. The university itself has also established a center for the studies of the United States. So hopefully with that, and also like engaging with other universities, they can bring up exchange programs whereby we can go there, learn how they do their things, adapt and come back, and they can also learn from us. So hopefully when he comes back, more centers in other universities and this one as well can be taken up so we can get to exchange and interact with them without many issues such as visas.
Second-year student Cynthia Wanjiru, who is studying international studies at the University of Nairobi, hopes the trip creates new economic opportunities, especially for the young.
Something we study in diplomacy, whereby when the heads of state are the ones which are meeting, it's easier for them to agree, easier for them to make decisions without much of a hassle. They're the ones who are in charge of their country. So I would want for him not only interact with the American president and people, but also to bring up job opportunities for the young people, investment opportunities here in Kenya, seeing that we've been going through some financial crisis here and there, that we can get more investment coming into the country, being able to export not only goods, but also our services as well.
Emmanuel Trokon Bani, a Liberian national studying international studies, thinks the visit will not benefit Africans.
I don't know what benefit actually would that his visit bring to Africa at large, because I think African leaders must hold hands together. African leaders must build an alliance. They must build solidarity to strengthen the Africa, the union, so that anything that's supposed to benefit Africa must be discussed among our African leaders. But the West always want to control our leaders. They always want to control our resources in Africa. They always want to control our politics, our governance system in Africa. So inviting President Ruto or inviting an African leader to the United States is a channel for which they want to use whenever they want to say something or what they want to do for their goals or their interests to be achieved in Africa.
You can find all the news about President Ruto's visit to the United States on voaafrica.com. As we reported, Kenyan President William Ruto is wrapping up a state visit to Washington today, the first by an African head of state in over a decade. VOA's Carol Van Dam has talked to Harry Verhoeven, political scientist and African economic expert at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University. He says Ruto is leveraging deeper ties with Washington to push for economic development help.
In many ways, Ruto's pitch that, you know, he's not just coming to talk about Haiti, for example, or he's not just coming to talk about bilateral issues between the U.S. and Kenya, but he's also here to have a broader conversation about the international development finance architecture. It harks back to some of the themes that Ethiopia engaged on in the last 10 or 15 years, in which it is essentially largely stopped doing. So in that sense, it meets both a kind of, if you like, a Kenyan aspiration, but also a felt need on the part of the U.S. to have this kind of privileged interlocutor who they can kind of bolster and kind of hand a bit of a microphone in the hope that that kind of substantially advances some of the interest that the U.S. sees in Africa as well as more globally.
Given all that, is the U.S. then prepared to help Kenya and other nations like it that it has, you know, good relationships with regarding these development funds?
Well, certainly at the discursive level, yes. I mean, there's a lot of goodwill in what the United States says. I think from the standpoint of many African countries, it's more about what it does or doesn't do that will actually matter going forward. So, for example, there's been a lot of kind of nodding to African suggestions that they need to have a bigger role in the international financial institutions, the IMF and the World Bank, not just in terms of voting power, but also in terms of agenda setting. There's not been a whole lot of engagement on that, in all honesty, in very concrete terms from the United States. Very similarly, there has indeed been a lot of talk that the U.S. will also make available more capital, for example, for infrastructure and other African development priorities. But the truth is that this is actually a very small share of what they would actually like to see coming, and certainly not a substitute for the money that African countries have tapped into from Gulf states or from China. So in that sense, there is a pretty big gap still. And Ruto talks a good game about how the United States is being helpful. But I think on the whole, most African countries are quite skeptical about how far this will actually go.
So you're saying, like, what they really need is they need to get some help and get some relief when they talk to the IMF and the World Bank. How much influence does the U.S. even have with those institutions in trying to help Kenya and other nations like it restructure their loans and so forth?
Well, I'd say it still has an enormous amount of influence. I mean, the major two initiatives that the World Bank and the IMF launched, the DSSI, the Debt Service Suspension Initiative on the one hand, and the Common Framework for Debt Treatments, were both very heavily influenced by U.S. ideas and by kind of U.S. thinking about, you know, both the nature of the debt issue and its potential solutions. So from an African standpoint, there's no question that the U.S. is the most important bilateral partner to at least try to restructure the multilateral framework. Part of the problem, however, is that, you know, the U.S. has been very adamant on focusing most of its attention on debt that is owed to official creditors, that is to say to other governments or international organizations. It has been less forthcoming in helping to deal with what has been the fastest growing component of African debt, which is the money that's owed to private creditors, for example, through bonds that were issued or loaned from commercial banks. And there, that's for many countries, including actually, ironically, for Kenya, much more American pressure or willingness to really force some of these private creditors to take a haircut is something that would make a meaningful difference to African countries.
That was Harry Verhoeven at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University. He was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam from New York. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. As South Africa prepares for elections next Wednesday, the Democratic Alliance Party is among those aiming to loosen the 30-year grip on power that the African National Congress has held since the end of apartheid in 1994. Darren Taylor reports.
The Democratic Alliance, or DA, got almost 21% of the vote in South Africa's last election in 2019. Surveys forecast a similar result this time around, with the DA not being able to take advantage of the African National Congress's many problems. The DA is led by John Steenhuisen, a 48-year-old career politician who's based his campaign around the slogan Rescue South Africa. Steenhuisen urges voters to unite to save the country from what he says is the ANC's corruption and damaging economic policies. If they don't support the DA, he says, the ANC and the radical leftist economic freedom fighters, the EFF, will ally in what he calls the Doomsday Coalition.
The Doomsday Coalition will expropriate property without compensation and abolish private property rights. The Doomsday Coalition will nationalize businesses, banks, and mines and destroy foreign investment. The Doomsday Coalition will plunge this country into an ethnic and racial conflict, the likes of which it has never witnessed before.
The DA's rescue plan includes state-owned enterprises partnering with private firms to deliver better services, ending the country's electricity crisis by rolling out renewable energy projects, using experts to help the police fight crime, firing corrupt officials, and ending the ANC practice of employing party loyalists to management positions. The DA promises to create 2 million jobs by loosening up the labor market, incentivizing small businesses to hire young people, and scrapping regulations that make it difficult for international enterprises to invest in South Africa. Independent political analyst Asanda Ngosheng says some DA policies are good. The problem, she says, is it's dominated by white leaders and cannot attract credible black personalities to win enough black votes.
This is why the DA will continue to play second fiddle, perhaps even third or fourth fiddle, to the ANC and the various other black organizations, they refuse to understand a critical thing. South Africa is a majority black country. And what that means is there is no way on this planet that you will be able to take over South Africa if you cannot connect with black South Africans and if you cannot acknowledge the history of black South Africans and acknowledge the pain of black South Africans.
The DA says it's the most racially diverse party in the country, drawing support from citizens of all colors. Research has shown, though, that its biggest base remains the white middle class. Studies do, however, also show that where the DA governs in one of South Africa's 9 provinces and many municipalities, it has a strong record of delivering services and jobs to black people. But Musi Maimane, the DA's first and so far only black leader, told a recent webinar his former party's obsession with defeating the ANC is hurting its prospects, along with what he called the DA's negative messaging.
To position the election as some rescue mission is bizarre for me.
The DA does, however, have a potential lifeline. It leads the multi-party charter, an alliance of 11 organizations that intend to pool their votes. That could be enough to unseat the ANC, say experts, but it's a long shot. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Under the Biden administration, U.S. veterans have received more than $5.7 billion in expanded health care benefits. But former President Donald Trump argues that veterans were better off when he was in the White House. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias looks at what the veteran population will likely need from the next president.
Nearly 890,000 U.S. veterans exposed to toxic substances during their service and their survivors have already benefited from the PACT Act, a law that President Joe Biden signed in 2022 to expand health care and benefits to those affected. On Wednesday, Biden announced that 1 million PACT Act claims have so far been granted.
Trouble breathing, cancer, brain cancer. Folks, you suffered long enough. You shouldn't have to prove that your illness came from their service. But thanks to the PACT Act, you don't have to prove it now.
Biden underscored that more than 30 bipartisan laws supporting veterans, their caregivers, and survivors had been passed under his administration.
We've increased resources to end veteran homelessness, hired and trained hundreds of additional mental health providers, specifically to help veterans end the silent scourge of veteran suicide.
Donald Trump, Biden's Republican rival in the 2024 presidential race, argues veterans fared better when he was president. Trump expanded on his argument in a video posted on the online video platform Rumble back in November.
We have 33,000 veterans in this country who are homeless and living very poorly, I might add, and it's a shame. We helped them a lot during my 4 years, and it's all been dropped.
If he returns to the White House, that will change, Trump added.
On day one, I will sign an executive order to cut off Joe Biden's massive spigot of funding for shelter and transport of illegal aliens and redirect a portion of those savings, a very large portion, I might add, to provide shelter and treatment for homeless American veterans.
The National Association of Social Workers hailed improvements to veterans' well-being under both the Biden and Trump administrations. The latter, for instance, increased veterans' access to support and care outside the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. But challenges remain, says Anthony Eastrit, the CEO of the National Association of Social Workers via Skype.
Individuals have been experiencing issues with access in terms of entering their system, but also barriers in terms of paperwork, significant wait times, and really just a lack of present workforce.
Estrid noted that the next U.S. president will need to pay special attention to facilitating veterans' access to mental health care, especially considering the provider shortages the field is currently experiencing. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Nigeria has the largest population of youth in the world, about 70% of the country's estimated 207 million people, according to Worldometer, a tracker for global population, government, and economy. But for decades, youth representation and inclusion in Nigerian politics has remained low, due in part to unfavorable national policies and the high cost of running for political seats. Some youth-led organizations and nonprofits are trying to change that by demanding reserved seats and a review of the cost of acquiring a nomination form. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Aspiring politician Jeffrey Natochukwu Nwokolo heads the youth arm of his political party, People's Democratic Party, in his hometown of Ugwaba in southeast Nigeria. The 29-year-old lawyer says the position paves the way for his ambition to contest for a seat at parliament in the next election.
No, so at this time, I've not contested election, and it's very intentional and deliberate. So I believe my life is a message, and for me, there's a roadmap which I'm following. But I really believe that the next electoral window would have me at the ballots.
But the stakes couldn't be higher.
From 1999 till date, my town of over 21 villages has never produced a commissioner within the state. My town has been neglected both in the House of Assembly positions, the House of Rep, the Senate. We really have not been given a seat in the table. So personally, I've decided to put myself forward.
Says Nwokolo. Nwokolo is hoping to be successful, but youth representation in Nigeria's elective seats is very low despite the young population size. Last year, less than 4% of the 360 positions in parliament were won by young people, an increase of 1% when compared to the previous election in 2019. High cost of elections, institutional barriers, and apathy are some of the reasons youth representation has been low. God Bless Utubure is the global president at Ready to Lead Africa, a development-focused nonprofit.
The cost of nomination forms have continued to increase. Even the parties that are supposed to be for the people are selling their forms 20 million, 30 million. It is the most, I don't know what to say. It's one of the most, it's one of the funniest attempts at pretending to want to solve problems.
In 2018, Nigeria passed a law that relaxed stringent constitutional age requirements needed to contest for office to get more young people to participate. But years later, little progress has been made, according to Olaniyan Sanusi, program officer at the nonprofit Yaga Africa, one of the pro-democracy groups that advocated for the law.
Despite the Not Too Young to Run Act, which came into law, there are still challenges for young people to operationalize the act, take advantage of that legislative of that alteration to the constitution. So we have a series of programs that are targeted at preparing young people who have shown interest to contest for political office. And it's basically to build their capacity around running issue-based campaign.
But in February this year, civil society groups and youth leaders from various political parties met in Abuja to demand 35% inclusion of youths in elective and appointed roles. They also recommended fee waivers for young aspirants. But for now, many young people will struggle to win a popularity contest against systems they say favor an older order. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And lastly, the European Union's anti-piracy force in the Indian Ocean and the Red Sea says a merchant vessel and its crew of 17 have been freed from suspected pirates off the coast of Somalia. Reuters says the Liberian-flagged Baslik was attacked by suspected pirates Thursday east of Somalia's capital, Mogadishu. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Tien Wong, Thanks for choosing The Voice of America.